Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Rest is History. This is our second bonus episode in a row where, tragically, we are not joined by podcasting legend and Spider-Man, Tom Holland. He is in Greece. So instead, this week, I am joined by another podcasting legend, actually. So the man who, on a day-to-day basis, makes the podcast work, and that is Dom Johnson. Hello, Dom. Welcome to the Rest is History.
Hello, Dominic. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. I mean, you're in charge, so basically you're having yourself on.
Yeah, I'll be sitting here for hours after this, editing it to make myself sound much more Rana Mitter-like.
Oh, very good. So, before we get into the nitty-gritty, some people have heard you on with Tom when I was on holiday last year, but some won't. So, why don't you sort of introduce yourself, as it were? Imagine you're giving a job talk and tell us, basically, how did you get into, what do you do on a day-to-day basis for The Rest is History? And how on earth did you get into this weird line of work?
Yeah, so I joined The Rest is History, I think, just around Christmas in 2021. And back then, it was just Tony and Jack, I think, were the two producers.
Yeah.
Before that, I was working for Goalhanger, but on the films and the documentaries and being a sort of archive researcher and archive producer there. And then Tony and Jack said, oh, we're expanding out the podcast side. So would you like to come across? We've got this brilliant history podcast. Two brilliant history podcasts. Would you like to get involved with that? And then so I joined the podcasting side. I do the recordings with you and Tom most of the time.
Yeah.
Do the edits, do the social media, working with Sam. And then we've got a few other people on the team now, but yeah, it was for quite a while. It's a lot of the time, like the Russia episodes, the Falklands War, the Churchill ones. It's just me, you, and me with my camera off, and you and Tom sat on the other side of the screen.
Do you actually listen when we're talking, or do you go away and do other jobs?
I do actually listen. Sometimes Tony bursts in and has some grand plans, and I sort of talk to him while listening with one headphone on. But it's, with Tom doing the singing at the moment, it's important to.
You've got to keep on top of that, haven't you? So how did you get into Goalhanger? Because you did you, am I right in thinking you did Spanish at university, or you lived in Spain or something like that?
Exactly, yeah. So I did, I went to the University of Leeds and did history and Spanish there. And then I went after university into TV. And then during the pandemic, I lived in Madrid after the really harsh lockdown and was working there, and then came back and got involved in television again. And because of the Goalhanger sports links, I came across to do that. And then, found my way into the stuff that I studied at university, and moved away from sport, which has been fun.
So do you think we should do more? I think we should do more Spanish stuff because we've basically done nothing on Spain, have we?
Yeah, I mean, I would love the Civil War and transition to democracy and things like that, huge topics. But the things I sort of focused on was Adolfo Suarez. And he was this quite amazing figure. He was like the head of the Spanish equivalent of the BBC, I believe.
Right.
And was sort of within the Franco structure of government, but he oversaw this quite amazing process where they did literally, when he died, just managed to transition to democracy. But I think we should do more on Spain. I think the coup in 83? And you're
81.
You're actually,
yeah,
81. Sorry, you're quite well versed in your Spanish history, aren't you?
Well, I could do the Spanish Civil War. Tom is frightened of the Spanish Civil War. I mean,
why is that?
He thinks there's an awful lot of acronyms. The POOM, all these kind of, these groups.
UGT and all these different...
The UGT, exactly. And a lot of factions. And I think he's just anxious about it. In the same way that he was anxious, I don't know if you remember, but when we did the American Civil War, Tom was absolutely gobsmacked when I said to him, I think the American Civil War is more than one episode, Tom. And he said, what?
Really?
Yeah, because he said, I'm just terrified. It's so boring. And everybody would be really bored by it. And he has no time for kind of congressional amendments and all of that kind of stuff. And he was sort of wading through it in the research. And he kind of rang me. Well, I mean, he rang me. He rings every single day anyway. But he rang but just when we were about to record with Adam Smith and said, are you sure all these episodes? Are you sure? And then even after we did it, he sort of said, there's a lot of legislation and congressional stuff. I'm very anxious about it. So I think Tom has a horror of modern conflicts that involve a lot of politics.
Right.
Because he thinks it'll be boring and everybody will get bogged down. But I think the Spanish Civil War is absolutely fascinating. Hugh Thomas's book, have you ever read that? or Paul Preston.
I've read Paul Preston, and there's you might have known when you were at Sheffield, like Mary Vincent and people like that are brilliant.
Yeah, I worked for Mary Vincent. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's loads of really good writing in English, actually, because actually it was English people who started writing that. So Hugh Thomas is the most famous one, his big book on the Spanish Civil War, which I think, now I may have got this wrong, so listeners can correct me, but I think was actually banned under the Franco regime. And he's not writing from, he was not writing from a left-wing perspective at all. But there's really always been this big tradition of British travellers from the 19th century onwards, or indeed American, I suppose, like Hemingway, sort of as it were Anglo-Saxons writing about Spain. And even now, there's lots of really, really good historians of Spain in British universities.
Yeah, it's interesting that. Have you read like Laurie Lee and...
Yeah, years ago. Yes, Gerald Brennan, I think. He went down to Andalusia. Yeah, there's lots of it. I think because Spain was often seen as the sort of polar opposite of Protestant England. So right. When English sort of writers, and also because from the 19th century, when Spain completely lost its position in the sort of first division, Spain was a sort of object lesson to English writers in backwardness. I mean, this may sound very harsh, but that's how they would have described it at the time. So they would go to Spain at a time when Britain was, you know, industrial and railways and all of this stuff. They would go to Spain and they would write about bullfighting and kind of plazas and damsels leaning out of windows with flowers behind their ears. And this sort of very, very idealized, romanticized vision of a kind of almost medieval Spain, which sort of is still lodged, I think, in the British imagination. You know, when people think about Spanish holidays, they sort of, and certainly in the 70s and 80s, when they went on holiday to Spain, it was all about, you know, flamenco dancing, bullfighting, you know, obviously the beaches. But there was this sort of image of Spain as preserved in aspic.
We touched on it in the holidays episode, I think. So that bucket and spade holiday and package tourism to Spain was just, you said it was fueled by, is it Franco just genuinely needing a lot of money?
Yeah, hard currency. Franco wanted hard currency, but also, I mean, they do genuinely have good beaches. didn't have to invent them.
Could we do Spain in the same way that we did Portugal, do you think, over four episodes, or do you think for some reason it would be different?
I think it would be, if anything, I think it would be very, very difficult. I mean, I'm not dissing Portuguese history, but Spanish history with its empire is very rich. So, I mean, a series on Spain would be fantastic. I mean, you could start with, obviously, the Reconquista and the creation of, the invention of Spain, I suppose you'd say, in the end of the 15th century. But then, so I'm writing a kid's book right now, Adventures in Time, which is all about the Spanish conquest of the Americas. And I'm just sort of wrestling with it now about how to make it work, because there's obviously Columbus's voyage, which obviously children are interested in. There's Cortez going to Mexico, Pizarro going to Peru, all the other places that people go to. I mean, obviously the whole of Latin America, with the exception of Brazil. But obviously the Spanish go to the Philippines, don't they? They you know, their reach is vast. If you're doing the Spanish Civil War, I think the Spanish Civil War could be multi-episode.
I think it needs to be,
as well.
Yeah.
Because if you've got all the foreign volunteers, you've got Guernica. Have you been to Guernica, Dom?
I haven't actually been to Guernica. I've seen the painting of it in the Reina Sofia in Madrid. Have you been?
Yeah, I have. So I've been to, we went to the Basque Country about just before the pandemic, it was, not 2019. San Sebastian is beautiful, you know, amazing and incredible food, and the kind of the pinchos and all that stuff. Bilbao, again, I loved Bilbao, absolutely adored it. But Guernica's kind of, it's probably a bit closer to Bilbao. And it really is just an absolutely nondescript sort of Spanish town.
What would the English equivalent be of Guernica?
Well, the English equivalent would be something like, you want to go to Stafford, you know, or I don't know, Yeovil or High Wycombe or something, you know, but it's quite small. So it's actually smaller than High Wycombe, I would guess. And there's nothing or very little that is old, because obviously it was all destroyed by the Condor Legion, by the Germans in the 1930s. But the two things, so they have a sort of a mural reproduction of Picasso's original painting, which everybody goes to see, which we went to see. I mean, it's very sleepy. Very few people go there. But the other thing they have that is very Lord of the Rings, they have this tree that is the sort of symbol of Basque nationhood and independence and all this sort of stuff. And this tree has been preserved, basically. I don't know. I can't remember the exact details. If we ever did this subject, I'd have to kind of
go to Bodleian.
But exactly, go to the Bodleian. But you know, we went and took photos by the tree and stuff. And I thought it's such a kind of Tolkien idea that these people have this tree that they've preserved even in the horrors of the Civil War and stuff. Which is, you know, as long as the tree is there, the sort of Basque identity will never be defeated and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that's a fantastic story in and of itself, I think.
Yeah, the Basque country in itself is bizarre, isn't it? With the, like, not bizarre, it's brilliant, but the way their football team, they only have, was it Athletic Bilbao, only have players born within the region are allowed to play for the team.
Yeah, that's right. So they've had a big controversy in recent years. Not a controversy, but they've started having basically second generation immigrants playing the team. So I think one of their strikers is Iñaki Williams, exactly, who's he's black. I can't remember where his parents are from, but he's as Basque, obviously, as any other Basque player. But it's just, but they still refuse, don't they, to have any Castilian players or Catalan players or Galician or whatever, which is. I quite like that, actually. I think there's a sort of place for that in a very globalized world.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And they kind of reached a peak a few years ago, didn't they, where they're beating clubs like Man United. But yeah, I think it's brilliant. If anyone who hasn't visited the Basque countries, definitely go, because it's completely different to the central Spain and a mile away from what southern Spain's like.
Yeah, sorry, definitely.
I think I've dragged you down a Spanish rabbit hole here.
No, I love that. I love, because I'm deep into, because I was spending this morning reading a book about called Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest.
Okay.
Absolutely amazing book, actually, about the Spanish in Mexico and Peru. Mm. And I'm deep into all this at the moment because, of course, what the cognitive struggle in a way that people have is they think of the sort of what happened in the Americas as completely different from what was going on in Europe, whereas the Spanish have literally only just beaten the Moors and conquered Granada, and they have this kind of crusading spirit, and Columbus, is still very interested in the idea of going to Jerusalem and all this sort of, it comes out of this medieval world of Spain. Mm. So I've sort of been, thinking a lot about Spanish history.
Definitely.
In recent days.
When's the Adventure in Time coming out?
It's coming out, God willing, if Tom has been sending me emails about public events, which I'm trying to get out of. So if I can say no to enough of those, then hopefully it should be finished in the spring and then out in the autumn next year.
Brilliant. Right, should we crack on with some of the correspondence we've had?
Yes.
Over the last week. Where would you like to start, Dominic?
I had some very nice birthday messages.
Oh, yes, happy birthday, belatedly.
Thank you. From Restless History Club members. So thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it.
Did you get given the stockings from... whose stockings were they?
Rudyard Kipling's.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're on sale in a Stanley Baldwin sale in Oxford. See, this is a very interesting Holland-Sambrook difference. Tom and I were chatting on the phone, and he said, so are you going to get those Stanley Baldwin things from that sale in Oxford? And I said, no, of course not. I'm not going to spend £5,000 on Stanley Baldwin's case or whatever, his dispatch box or Rudyard Kipling's leggings. I mean, that would be a ludicrous way for me to spend my money. Tom was astounded that I'd taken this position. And I said, I couldn't justify that to my family, Tom. By the way, I've emptied the bank account in order to buy some of Stanley Baldwin's like memorabilia. But Tom, obviously with his dinosaur buying, thought this was absolutely lily-livered, weak.
I wonder, did they sell? Do you know? We'll have to look it up.
Must have sold. I don't know. I'll have to check it out.
You will. Did you enjoy your birthday? What did you get? What did you get up to?
We didn't do anything very interesting, actually, Tom. We just had a quiet weekend at home. It amazed people to hear that I had some books for my birthday, among other things. So it was good. Yeah, it was good.
Perfect.
It was fine. Same birthday as Richard III, mm-hmm. I believe. And... who else? Sting.
Oh, nice.
The big three, as people call us. Now, we did have a question about politics, didn't we? Do you do the Restless Politics, Tom?
I do, yes. So I'm the producer on that as well. That's my main sort of day-to-day, the Restless History and the Restless Politics.
And they're never in the same... I mean, I know they've recently been in the same room, but usually they're not in the same room, are they?
No. So they're normally in Rory is between New York and Amman in Jordan, and Alistair is in North London. So yeah, they're
right.
Always recorded virtually. And I guess this is something that probably rest history listeners might not, well, I think the Wangs would all know, but general listeners, is we very, very, very rarely record in person, which I think works to our benefit in a lot of ways, because even like today in this recording here, if you talk over someone in person, or you cough, or you sneeze, or you do anything, make a noise, you have to leave it on the in the recording. Whereas when we record like this, if you, there's a lot of times when Tom or yourself would like try and come in, and then, or, and you can just dip it down and it...
Just think about that sentence that you said. Who is the person who always tries to come in?
Yeah, there are, I think on the cutting room floor, there's quite a lot of Tom Holland. Well, or, like there's a lot
but
of
But Dominic,
that.
Dominic, yeah. But Dominic. That, I mean, the number of times I've heard, I think I've heard those words more than anything else on this podcast.
I reckon there must be about a handful of listeners who have noticed this, but they may have noticed that trick that we do where we dip. It's if you try and come in, the level of Tom's voice quickly rises,
oh,
and sometimes
right.
we dip you down and leave Tom, but it does sometimes sound like he's for some reason interneting in a bizarre way. But
that's
funny. We've managed. You guys are pros at it now, but when you have guests and different people on, it can be really beneficial to be recording virtually.
Yeah, because I mean, it's sometimes hard, isn't it? To we're obviously very used now to the dynamic, the ecosystem of talking on Zoom, of talking to each other and anticipating when the other person's going to talk and stuff. But if you have guests, sometimes they don't really know when we're going to...
Mm. Have you found that do they either stay quiet or do they jump in too much? Which way around?
There's a sort of funny thing with guests, isn't there? There's a sweet spot where we just have a guest and they're brilliant. And it's not about the knowledge and not even about how engaging they are. It's about sort of reading the style and the conversational sort of dynamic. So you'd have some guests, I'm not going to name any names, but there'd be a couple of guests that we've had where we've sort of read their books or something. And we've said, you know, and that brilliant thing happened in 1350, didn't it? That's an extraordinary moment, thinking they'll then tell the story. And they just say, yes. And then there's a dead silence. And you're like, tell the bloody story. Or the alternative is the guest who thinks, especially if they're an academic and they're used to lecturing, you know, you press go and then they just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and you can never get in. And sometimes that works if they're absolutely brilliant, like Rana. I mean, Rana, basically, Tom and I were completely and utterly redundant in that episode. But it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's a funny thing. It's easy for us because we can just sit at home very comfortably, which lends itself to the casual nature of the recording. I mean, it's such a difference from both Tom and I had done loads of Radio 4. And, you know, you'd go into the BBC and you'd sit very stiffly kind of behind this desk, and they've got the producers and everything has got to be perfect and the soundproof rooms, and you're sort of slightly, you've got your lanyard, your visitor's lanyard around your neck, and it's all sort of, it's all just a bit over formal, so that you never really relax and have fun. And you can tell that in the recordings. I mean, obviously the brilliant broadcasters are able to impart that anyway, and Tom and I are not in that league. So, but I think it's, to do it like this, where literally, you know, you all have sent us a time and said, guys, you know, 10 a.m. tomorrow, and we'll sort of turn up at 9:59 with our cups of tea in our slippers, basically. I mean, it makes it so much more, I think it really makes for a more relaxed, chatty recording than if we were in the same room, kind of slightly antagonistically staring at each other across a table, very kind of poised, you know, in an unfamiliar environment.
I think you're definitely right. I think it suits podcasting so much more being like this. Because imagine if you had to, like you did for your first ever recording, which I wish I've been present at in Tom's daughter's house, but traveling there, getting to an unfamiliar place, as you say. But I've noticed that actually, well, and we should give credit to you and Tom, because compared to radio shows, I mean, you guys do 99.9% of the research and all the planning around an episode.
What's happened to that 0.01?
That 0.01 was Tony's intros that he used to write.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like I think I've worked on podcasts with a few other people and worked in different audio things down the years, and the degree to try and overthink podcasts is very common, and people trying to structure it really rigidly, whereas sometimes when we record big series, I say, oh, how many episodes do we reckon here, and you go, don't know, let's just see.
Yeah, let's just talk and see because Tom and I both do think about how it's going to go, and we both have our own separate ideas about introductions and let's go on with this. And so it's not like we haven't thought about it.
No.
We absolutely have thought about it. And sometimes we will both have reams of notes. I mean, we'll massively kind of over-prepare. But I think it's so liberating not having that BBC straitjacket where every syllable has not merely been scripted, but it has been submitted for approval to commissioners and controllers and stuff, so that your words have passed completely out of your control and been revised in a way that sometimes you find that line isn't me. And they're like, oh no, we have to put that in now because the controller specifically asked for it. You know, that kind of thing is infuriating as a presenter. So it's nice to not have to do it. Anyway, Tom, we were meant to be talking.
Yeah, sorry.
I said about the rest is politics because Barry Grogan had a question, who had the first worst month as Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng or Ian McLeod?
So tell me about Ian McLeod.
So Ian McLeod, he became Chancellor in 1970. He was Ted Heath's Chancellor and he died after a month. So that, yeah, he was a very sick man. He'd always been ill. He had various sort of conditions. So he was hunched. He was clever. He was a brilliant card player, bizarrely. He'd effectively been virtually a professional card player after leaving Oxford or Cambridge or wherever he was. I can't remember. I've written about him, but I've completely forgotten about him, to be honest. Anyway, he died. So that was a bad month for him. And subsequently, when Ted Heath's premiership ended in tears, people sometimes said, oh, if McLeod had been Chancellor rather than Anthony Barber, who was a disastrous Chancellor, then maybe Ted Heath could have survived and the whole of British kind of very recent history would have played out differently. Kwasi Kwarteng, I mean, he's still alive. I mean, he's physically alive, if not politically. I can't think of any Chancellor who's come in and basically unveiled all these measures and had such a disastrous reaction from the financial markets with the pound plunging, and then had to row back on what was his great kind of coup de théâtre at the end of his speech when he said he was cutting the top rate of tax or eliminating the top rate of tax. To row back on that is absolutely humiliating.
Do you think he's the most, I don't know, as we said there, I don't know if it's the worst month as Chancellor, do you think he's the most self-assured Chancellor we've had in modern times?
Yeah, I posted this on the Discord because there was some chat about him. He's written two history books, at least two history books. He wrote a book about money, the history of money, and he wrote a book about called Ghosts of Empire, about the legacy of the British Empire, in which he picked sort of seven or eight different places. I don't know, Nigeria, Singapore, whatever. I mean, he wrote these books while he was a Tory MP. His reputation is, very clever, very self-assured. I've met, I think, a couple of people in my various sort of school talks and things who taught Kwasi Kwarteng, and both of them said, unbelievably intelligent boy. You know, he clearly knows it, wears it very openly. So Ian McLeod, who we compared him with, it was famously said of him, I think by the then Marquess of Salisbury in the 1950s or 60s, that he was too clever by half. And that kind of created this idea in that the Tory party hates people that are too clever by half. And I suspect there's a lot of people in the Tory party who think that of Kwasi Kwarteng and will be delighted to see him brought down, actually. I suspect he's the kind of politician who has probably quite a lot of enemies. So, he's incredibly self-assured, isn't he?
Yeah, I think I was speaking to Rory about him. We don't want to go down this, turn this to a politics podcast, but he was saying, if you ever disagreed with him, he's just sort of 6'4", really like deep voice, very confident figure. He would just say, Rory, you're just being so silly. And he would never engage with the argument. He would just say, you're being silly.
Yeah, he's an enormous man. And sort of, I think that combination of being physically very imposing and being intellectually, very superpowered is not necessarily good for you. It's not good for your humility, is it? I think it's fair to say. I don't think there's been... I was trying to think, quite a few people have been asking, has there been a prime minister who has got off to such an awful start, to find themselves 33 percentage points behind in the opinion polls within weeks of coming in when normally they would be having a honeymoon, and there isn't actually... There's no example of anybody who's ever had a worse start, I would say, and certainly not there might be one of these characters from the 18th or early 19th century no one's heard of, but definitely not since, you know, the days of Gladstone and Disraeli, I would have said.
Do you think it would have been worse than in December 2019 if John McDonnell had been Chancellor? Do you think it would have been a similar, like the market swing, or do you think it would have been even bigger?
That's a very good question. It depends what he'd have done. I think there would have been, there's no doubt there would have been a market reaction. Yeah. So whether it's worse, I don't know. I think the financial markets would definitely have taken a dim view of, I mean, the thing with the financial markets, right, and this is a history point, because successive British governments often make this point. Bill Clinton was very aggrieved in the 1990s. You know, he used to go on and on about the bond markets and how they were his enemy to his advisors, how it was disgraceful that the bond markets would decide whether or not he was reelected in 1996. And in the 60s, when the Wilson government, Labour government, and the 70s, when they were constantly sort of struggling whether or not to devalue the pound, and you know, they were constantly being sort of buffeted, and they ended up in 1976 having to go to the International Monetary Fund when James Callaghan was Prime Minister. There would always be this sort of talk that the market's unpatriotic. The markets are run by evil plotters who hate our project. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, you can say what you like about the financial markets, but you just can't argue with them. If they're not going to buy your government debt, if they're not going to buy your bonds, if they don't want to invest in the pound, no amount of you browbeating them and shouting is going to change it. They're just not going to do it. So you basically just have to work with it. Now, some people, I think in the 70s, you know, there were people on the left of the Labour Party who basically said, it's a disgrace. You can't, you know, we have to subordinate our vision to these, to sort of financials, the forces of financial speculation. But I mean, the alternative is, well, in that case, withdraw from the world financial system. You know, I mean, that's the nature of the game. If you don't want to play, fair enough, but then don't expect anyone to lend you any money. I mean, that's basically the issue. Anyway, we have spiraled into politics. This is what happens when Tom goes to Greece. Somebody said Tom just seems to be spending all his time watching Mamma Mia. Which I think is not true, actually, because Tom sent me a picture yesterday. I said, how's your holiday? Because I was feeling bad, because Tom has had such a terrible time about his Marilyn Monroe impersonation, which I'm sure we'll come to.
And he's about, taken flight.
He's exactly. He's fled the country, and he's just, his Twitter timeline is just full of people who've only just discovered the episode saying, oh my God, what an abomination. So I was feeling sorry for him, because I knew that I had basically absolutely pulled
set him up.
Fuel on this fire. I didn't set him up. I told him not to do it. But once people started sending in their reactions, I was very keen to amplify them. So I felt bad about this. And I said to Tom, how's your holiday going? And he said, it's great. I'm just about to take a group of teenage girls up a mountain. That's not a euphemism, by the way. He was about to take them up this mountain. And he sent me a photograph of his daughter and I assume two of her friends looking about as miserable as you could ever expect three teenage girls to look. So Tom is clearly continuing absolutely true to form, dragging people to obscure archaeological sites in punishing heat, which I think is how all parents should behave, actually. So
definitely.
Good for him. So what else have we got, Dom? What else do you want to talk about?
Would you like to touch on Churchill?
Sure, yes.
Oh, before we actually get onto that, probably the last thing on the Tom's Marilyn Monroe impression, I think the most revealing thing from it was when Capel Loft said, he was saying it was a creepy impression, but I think what gave Capel Loft away was saying, it makes his Prince in the Tower sound like Nigella Lawson. I'm intrigued at Capel Loft's Nigella comparison there. It must be sort of his...
Yeah, that's his own private, you know, his own private interests, isn't it? Nigella Lawson, I suppose, does have, I mean, she's famous. Does she not have a sexy voice?
I think that's what Capel's implying. I just didn't expect it from him.
No, I wouldn't have thought she'd be his type, to be honest.
She's a bit Whiggish, is she not?
Yeah. Yeah, she's got very unsound views on the politics of the age of Queen Anne. So I saw online that I know some people, the Rest is History Club members, roll their eyes at the mention of this individual, but he's just signed a book deal to publish about late 17th, early 18th century politics.
Capel Loft,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Have we had a role in that? We should be getting a share.
I know, we should be getting a share, because that's, I mean, he had his own identity before the rest is history. But we definitely gave him airtime with his Charles I mongering. He'll definitely have to come on to, yeah, have to come on to talk about it. One other thing we should talk about. We have had some dissing for our podcast about fashion. Did you see this, Dom?
I did, yeah. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it was actually really about two people, so let's not over-exaggerate it. On Twitter said, I can't believe you've done this, such a fluffy, rubbish subject. Fashion in the age of Jane Austen, the Regency Revolution. You have nothing to say about it. These podcasts are useless whenever you talk about these girly subjects. These people aren't that you invite on are not real historians. They're just writing about bonnets, all this sort of stuff. Hillary, our guest, was outraged by this and posted very not intemperate, actually. She was perfectly temperate. She posted a very forthright defense of her area, of her subject. And I actually thought that anybody objecting to this as not history is a baboon, frankly.
No, I completely agree. And I thought she was a brilliant guest.
She was a good guest. She was really fun. It's a really different... You know, Tom and I, if we have a fault, I don't believe we do, Dom, but if we do have a fault, we like to do our own comfort zones. I mean, it's our podcast. That's what we want to do. But so we do try to make an effort to have different things, to have more unexpected things. This was one of them. Tom sorted it out. He was very keen on it. He was super enthusiastic, and he was right to be, because I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good change. Obviously, we knew we had Churchill coming up. And also, this thing that this is history and this isn't.
It's ridiculous.
There's no history police. There's nobody who tells you that this is not history. And, I do history, so I know. Anything, the historian decides what's history. The historian looks into the past and says, this is interesting. I'm going to talk about, and it could be baths. It could be... smells, it could be hats, it could be wars and battles and, as inverted commas, grey men, but it absolutely doesn't have to be. And the argument that the only wars and great men and politics are significant actually completely misses the fact that to most people at any given moment, they're not significant really at all. Unless you're in the heart of them, you don't care. You know, if you were living in the Wars of the Roses, there are huge parts of England where people couldn't give a damn what was going on in some glorified punch up in a field 300 miles away. You know, in my books, I write about food. I write about fashion from the 60s, 70s, 80s. I write about music, houses, you know, all kinds of things. Because, I mean, for a historian, the whole of the human experience is your subject. And basically, there's no such thing as fluff.
Do you think they have those opinions, or do you think they're trying to, is that the best way, as we're saying, to get noticed? As if you say stuff like that, and
no, some people definitely do have those opinions. I mean, they've always, I mean,
I think a strength of the pod has been that we're unapologetic in our choices. I don't think we've ever backed down from anything except
no.
The 52 advert we did for the members.
That's true. Yeah, the outrage at that excessive advertising. No, but I mean, Dom, this goes back to that thing we were talking about the difference in podcasting and radio. I mean, so if you're the BBC and you're Radio 4 and you do a documentary, you feel a terrible responsibility to your audience because it's a national audience and because you're publicly funded or funded by the license fee. So at the BBC, there's this sort of culture of, it's not so much never apologize, never explain. It's kind of always apologize. when I did my TV series about the 80s, I think we might have talked about this once in a bonus episode. When I did my TV series about the 80s, about a week before it went out, somebody at the BBC said, can he write thousands of words? That's in me. Could I write thousands of words of explanation and sort of semi-apology for putative complaints that had never been made? In other words, the program had not yet gone out, but can you prepare your answers for the complaint?
Did they give you a steer on complaints, where they'd be?
They didn't. No, they said, you and the producer should figure that out. And the producer said this to me, and I was absolutely, I just said, I'm not doing that. I'm not wasting, 2 days typing a massive Word document about complaints that I don't believe will ever be made, because I think it's good. And we didn't get any complaints, but I thought it was absolutely symptomatic of that kind of attitude, which is, oh, you must sort of, in a very Uriah Heep way, kind of wring your hands and say how humble you are and how dreadfully sorry. The good thing with doing a podcast is everybody knows it's just mine and Tom's podcast, and yours, of course, Dom. So basically, everybody knows it's ours. We're not pretending that it's something it's not. And if people don't like it, or they don't like the choice of subject, well, I mean, ultimately, this will sound very harsh. I hope our members don't all leave after me saying this. But ultimately, you know, boo-hoo. It's our podcast.
Agreed.
We don't oblige anybody to listen. So anyway, that's
a very Churchillian view of a.
It is a very well. So that's a very good link, Dom. Beautifully done. You've definitely got a future in the media. Let's talk about. So did you listen? Did you record those three Churchill episodes?
So I recorded those three, and I edited the first and third. And I thought, I must say, I think up there with I tell you what we need to tell everyone, Dominic, is the story about the phone and the cliffhanger in a minute, but. I thought the third episode, which members have already had, where it talks about him escaping the Pretoria prisoner of war camp on a train.
Yeah.
I reckon it is up there with the best stories we've done. But yeah, when we were recording this, listeners, Dominic was just up to the moment where Churchill knocks on the door of a house and he's basically brandished with a gun.
The gun is between them on the table.
Yeah, it's between them on the table.
Because you sent me that clip, Dom. I say, the man said, you better come in. Churchill says, I better tell you who I am. The gun is between them. And Tom, what happens next is, and at that point, Tom's phone started ringing.
It's like a 70-year-old phone that's sort of like a landline with a brilliant ringtone. And Dominic just stops dead in his tracks. And we were thinking as putting it out as a promo because Dominic just sort of goes, and Tom goes, 1 second, picks up the phone. And then we pick up seamlessly. It unfortunately didn't make the edit, but yeah. But what did you think of those Churchill ones? I thought they were, I love those sort of General Gordon, Churchill, these figures that we dive right into. And I think they make for some of the best rest history we do.
Yeah, I do. I like them as well. We'll probably come to a couple of listeners' comments. I know not all listeners. So some listeners take, I think deep down, take exception to them as characters because they sort of say imperialists, you know, Victorian Britons, bad people. I want you to tear them down. And basically, if I do a billion episodes of this podcast, that I'm not in that game. Not that I'm in the game of putting them on pedestals, but I think approaching them in either a sort of very censorious or a very hand-wringing spirit that is alien to the Sandbrookian method, I think it's fair to say.
Never apologize.
No. Well, I mean, I would say definitely explain, but I don't think we're in the business of... No, I think the thing is, whatever you think, whatever anybody thinks of Churchill, Tom and I think we both would say we really loved doing the research for that episode. We loved the subject. Whatever you think of him, those escapades undoubtedly happened, and they are an amazing story. I mean, they're a tremendous story. And he is an infectious character. I mean, even people you don't need to apologize for this, because even his opponents at the time, they found Churchill an incredibly charismatic magnet, even if they despised him, actually. I hate to say it. It does pain me to say it, because I know some listeners will be outraged by this. Boris Johnson is not an utterly ludicrous comparison, because one thing they do have in common, I know, of course, already lots of people have switched off because they say Boris is the absolute scum of the earth compared to anybody else or whatever. But the one thing they definitely have in common is the sense of charisma and being there, a sense of attention. But also, even people who I know can't stand Boris Johnson have told me he is fun to be around. And that was definitely true of Churchill. That there were lots of people, by the way, who thought Churchill was terribly unreliable and untrustworthy. But they would always say, if he's in the room, it's a more interesting room than one in which he's not in the room. And I think that's clearly true of some people. It's true of like Bill Clinton, let's say. There are people who have this indefinable characteristic of charisma that as historians, it's very frustrating because you can never define it, but people have it.
It's a jet, do you think they've just got similarities in, because you mentioned this in the first episode, I think, similarities in personality, or do you think Boris Johnson chose or aimed and tried to be like Churchill in his personality?
He definitely chose. It was definitely a choice. The one interesting similarity they have is that they both had very, very a complicated sort of family backgrounds. Mm,
that's true.
So Boris Johnson had a father who was, I mean, God almighty, Tom said Lord Randolph Churchill was a shower. I mean, I don't know what he'd make of Stanley Johnson. Yeah, who also doesn't come out well of any biography of Boris Johnson. His mother, Boris Johnson's mother, was institutionalized at various points with mental illness. She was an artist.
Is she American?
Is she American? No, I don't think she is American. I think she's British.
Does Boris not have American roots?
Maybe we should do some live research, Dom. Charlotte Fawcett. No, she's British. She's born in Oxford.
Cut.
No, don't cut that. Leave that in. Leave that in because it's authentic. So anyway, he had a very troubled background. And obviously, he went to Eton. Boris did. Churchill went to Harrow. But in both cases, there was this sort of desire to make themselves the center of attention, you know, to make themselves a character, you know, to be playing a part, which they both do. The difference, I think, is that Churchill was often quite funny, but he never was a figure of fun. So in all those three young Churchill podcasts, he often does or says funny things, but he's not a comic figure. He's brave. Right. You know, he's riding into battle. He's jumping off trains. He's doing Indiana Jones kind of things, isn't he? Boris Johnson, the difference with him is he made himself into a combination of two characters. So one was Winston Churchill, the other is Bertie Wooster. The sort of always late, always apparently scatty, forgotten everything, in a shambles, very funny, posh, all of that sort of stuff. Churchill never played the Bertie Wooster sort of figure. He was never kind of scatty and shambolic and all of those things for comic effect. So that is a big, big difference. Also, Churchill was genuinely brave things. So not just physically brave, but switching parties, for example, when he crosses the floor, he literally crosses the floor of the House of Commons in, I think, when is it, 1904 or something like that, to join the Liberals.
Did he do that? Did he do that for moral reasons, or was it expedient? Was he looking to be?
No, it wasn't expedient. It wasn't expedient. It was political reasons. He was unwelcome in the Tory party. He had fallen out with them about a number of issues. Most obviously, he was a free trader, and they had gone for protectionism, imperial preferences, it was called. He was passionate about free trade, so that's why he walks out and he physically crosses, you know, and loses lots of friends and colleagues and stuff. I mean, that takes a bit of courage, I would say. I mean, obviously, there's different kinds of courage. It's not the courage of somebody doing a sit-in in a segregated restaurant in Alabama in the 1950s or something, but it's courageous in its way. I don't think Boris Johnson has ever done anything similarly courageous in his life.
Was it Nick Bowles? Was it? Did he cross the floor? Or did he just become an independent?
Nick Bowles, he's a peer now, isn't he? I think, is he a peer?
Yeah, but was it not him? Do you remember those weird Brexit votes they did?
Oh, yes, that's right. There were a few people like that, weren't there? I'd completely forgotten that.
That bizarre series where they did the sort of straw poll. I can't even remember that. Did it. Brexit tests.
Indicative votes. Was it? Was that what it was called?
Indicative votes, yeah.
It was those days of the Theresa May premiership when they couldn't agree what they wanted. And so they said, we'll hold these series of votes because they didn't want Theresa May's deal. And so they had the indicative votes, but nothing else ever won, did it? Do you remember that everything no. else got voted down by a different kind of majority? I mean, it was just an absolutely ludicrous.
Shambles.
It was a shambles. The difference now is that people change parties all the time. Very common. In those days, it was much more uncommon.
Oh, okay.
So for Churchill to do it, so sometimes factions would break away. So the liberal unionists in the late 19th century under Joseph Chamberlain had left and formed their own kind of faction, left the Liberal Party about Irish Home Rule. But for one person to, especially when it's that society world where everybody you know, they all go, they're all part of the same clubs, all of that kind of thing. It's a much bigger step, I think, in the 1900s than it would be today.
Mm, no, definitely. And I was intrigued, actually, when we got that email you sent to me from Justin Reach, the director of the Churchill Centre is it in the US?
Yes, in America.
Saying how much you enjoyed the episode. Is it? Because, and we've had another, I assume it's American, Chris 85, asking about the comparisons and contrasts between Roosevelt and Churchill himself. Is there a big interest in Churchill in the States and comparisons like this? And why do you think that is?
Bigger, I would say, than in Britain. So Chris 85 was asking about Theodore Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt, the Churchill, is famous for having gone to stay with him during World War II and form this alliance and stuff. But Theodore Roosevelt is more similar to Churchill because he went on adventures and was all about imperialism. And, you know, he's basically the American Winston Churchill, I suppose you would say.
Right.
And Chris 85 says, I mean, he says they love the Navy. They're both romantic about war and about masculinity. And he's absolutely right. They're very, very similar characters. An interesting thing, Andrew Roberts writes about this in his biography, is that when Churchill, I think, went to New York on one of his trips, he is introduced to Theodore Roosevelt, and they're so similar they don't get on at all, because basically there's only room for, they both want to play the same part, and there's only room for one of them in the conversation, if you know what I mean. So the American, yeah, to a particular kind of American, I think ultimately a fairly right-wing American, actually, Churchill has a kind of iconographic meaning. So, you know, George W. Bush had a bust of Churchill in the Oval Office. Barack Obama took it out.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was this huge hullabaloo. He hates Britain. Isn't this terrible? Boris Johnson, I think, wrote a column about it and said it's because he's Kenyan background. He's full of bitterness towards Britain, which was rubbish. American presidents, when they come in, they always change the furniture and they put up statues and busts of their heroes. There's no obligation to anybody to have a bust of Winston Churchill.
Did George Bush...
He had put it in.
Did he bring it in? Yeah.
Yeah, because Clinton hadn't had it.
So it hadn't been there for decades?
No, I don't think it had. I mean, maybe some listeners will know more about this and will correct me, but I don't believe it had. I think George W. Bush was attached to it for obvious reasons. I mean, he'd say Churchill was a war leader threatened by a terroristic menace. So obviously somebody like George W. Bush would want to cultivate the parallel. If you're a sort of American Republican, let's say, you're not going to have the hang-ups about Churchill's imperialistic baggage that a British academic is going to have. So they can sort of, you know, they kind of love Churchill and venerate him as this great figure of history, very pro-American, a symbol of the special relationship, all this sort of stuff, without kind of any, you know, they just think Churchill's wonderful and he's a standing rebuke to appeasement. But they're only really interested, now maybe Justin will correct me on this, I think they're only really interested in the World War II Churchill and the anti-appeasement Churchill. I mean, I don't think they're interested in Churchill's views about tariff reform or his attitude to women's suffrage in the 1900s and 1910s or something.
Do you think, is he the figure most now in casting sort of history and statues and in memory as like their timeless image is them as this, the oldest version almost of themselves? I had no image in my head of this young Churchill. I couldn't even tell you what he'd looked like, whether he was big like he was in older age or small. Like, it seems like, yeah, it's a period of his life forgotten more than most, I guess, because he went on to do so much in later life.
Yeah, it's true. That's a good question. I think there are some world leaders, particularly from the 20th century, who you do think of them as older. So maybe de Gaulle, maybe Konrad Adenauer, who is the leader of Germany. Yeah. I mean, young Stalin looks a bit, because we're used to seeing an older Stalin or an older Lenin. Arguably, is that because people became famous slightly later in age, I suppose? Mm. I mean, conversely, then I suppose a counter argument to that would be that when we think of Henry VIII, because I often do my Adventures in Time talks about Henry VIII to kids, you know, when I'm on my sort of book tour things. And one of the things I do, listeners will be astounded to hear that I use some quite cheap gimmicks. So I kind of have two images that I say is old Henry and young Henry. So I start with young Henry. I say, now you think of Henry VIII as very fat, but here's how he was when he was young. And I've got a picture that I found of Prince Harry falling out of a nightclub with a baseball cap on when he was in his 20s. And I say, this is the young Henry VIII. And then I say, and here is the old Henry VIII, and it's the great goblin from the Hobbit films, who was voiced by Stephen Fry, I think, and is absolutely enormous. He's this vast kind of whale-like figure. But we don't think of the young Henry VIII, do we? I mean, you don't think of him as young and sporty. You think of him as like a great bloated kind of wife-devouring figure. And with Churchill, Churchill is so enshrined now as that hulking statue in Parliament Square, or as the sort of the figure in a, you know, in his big coat, kind of touring the bombed out London and all that sort of thing, that you're right. I mean, it's that kind of question that children ask. Small children will often ask, when I go to heaven, right, what version of me? Like, because, I mean, you know, be there when you're like, will you be there preserved in your aged, decrepit state? And
or in your pomp.
Or in your pomp. Yeah. What's your moment? What would you choose?
Right then, Dominic. I think we've been whittling on for long enough.
Yeah, we have, Dom. We've been talking for, I mean, this is the unbelievable thing. So when Tom is gone, we do very long bonus podcasts. So I don't know what that says. I have my question mark, as you know, about Tom's stamina. I don't think Tom likes the long recordings. I like the multi-episode recording, and Tom doesn't. Whenever we get to the end of it, you can tell, I can see that Tom is losing the will to live, because he'll just be like, come on, Dominic, tell the end of the story. Let's go. But anyway, yes, we probably have gone on a bit too long, haven't we? So what are we... Tom's not here next week. That's right, isn't it?
No, he's not. So we'll have to sort out. Maybe we'll get Jack on again or something like that. And what episodes have we got coming up?
So for normal listeners, they get the final Churchill one at the beginning of next week. We've got a history of France through film with a brilliant guest, Muriel Zaga, French film critic. We will be doing an episode about the Battle of Trafalgar for Trafalgar Day. We have a two-part epic about the life of Lady Jane Grey, the 9 Days Queen, and some other stuff, and I can't remember. Norse magic, Viking magic. Viking
Norse sorcery. Magic.
Yeah, which Brilliant. I'm very much looking forward to.
Excellent. Well, thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you, Dom. Thank you for coming on The Rest is History. And to all of you, thank you for listening. It's goodbye from me, and...
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.